This is John Himmel. I'm here about to speak with Casey Taft. He's a researcher at the National Center for PTSD. He's also a professor of psychiatry at the Boston University School of Medicine. He is the recipient of the Linda Salzman Memorial Intimate Partner Violence Researcher Award from the Institute on Violence, Abuse, and Trauma and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which he received a few years ago. His research focuses primarily on intimate partner violence among veterans and issues related to PTSD. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So let's go ahead and get started. I'm really, really pleased to be speaking with you. Tell us first about the Strength at Home program. What is the program and when was it first developed? Tell me a little bit about it.
Sure, yeah. This is a program. It really started, I guess, about 10 years ago. We were funded through a grant from the Department of Defense to develop an evidence-based trauma-informed intervention for military veterans and service members. Really, there hadn't really been anything for IPV intervention or prevention that had been shown to be effective in randomized controlled trials. And as you know, what sometimes happens in the military is, programs are sort of thrown out there because there's an urgent need for it, and they're not always really fully evaluated. So we wanted to do something where we had some evidence behind it. We had, some of the big names in the IPV field as well as the trauma field who helped us put the program together, such as Patty Rizik, who developed cognitive processing therapy for PTSD, Candace Monson, who's a couples and PTSD researcher, Chris Murphy, who's developed, as you know, developed IPV interventions. So we had a lot of great people help us kind of put it together, and then we did a randomized controlled trial, and ultimately it proved to be effective in that study.
Tell us, for those of us listeners listening in to the ADVIP series of podcasts, such as this one, please explain what you mean by random assignment of conditions research. Not all of our members know what that is.
And I think it is important that people know about that, because for a lot of IPV interventions, a lot of IPV interventions that folks say is evidence-based, they haven't actually been shown to be effective through randomized controlled trials. So, just like with the drug trial, you don't learn a lot about a drug if you just give it to all their participants. And and many of them make changes because you don't know if folks would have changed anyway, just over just through the passage of time, or in drug trials, often what they do is they give a placebo, so they give or they give an alternative treatment, so you can confidently say that if folks who take your drug do better than folks who are in the other condition or getting another intervention. And then you can more confidently say that your drug works. And it's the same kind of idea with IPV interventions. We know that when folks get arrested and get court ordered to a program, just fear of getting rearrested is going to go a long way towards preventing recidivism. We know that protective orders, lack of contact or access to the victim, all kinds of factors play a role in whether folks end their abuse. So just showing that people reduce their abuse from baseline to post-treatment or follow-up isn't really telling you a whole lot unless you have folks going through a comparison condition, so you can more confidently say that your program is effective because folks did better in who were doing your program rather than another program or treatment as usual or what have you.
Right. So that very, very good explanation there. So for example, with traditional Duluth model or cognitive behavioral therapy models, these have not been shown to be as effective as we would have liked when tested with a random assignment of conditions methodology. So compared to studies by Babcock and others finding just minimal effectiveness based on these highest standards of research for battle intervention programs, where does Strength at Home fit in terms of its effect sizes, how well it works under these methodologically sound conditions?
You can't really compare these studies across. You can't really compare across studies very well because, you know, they're all in different jurisdictions, different programs, different populations. So I think it's a bit, you know, difficult to say that, you know, to do that it that way.
Right.
And that's why, you know, it's kind of the test is built into your study itself, where you're kind of testing the same group of the same population of folks going through one program or another. So as far as I know, there really aren't really other programs that have really been shown to be effective through randomized control trials. I could be wrong. I mean, I know there's, you know, a study here and there, but usually there's methodological issues or limitations to them. In our study for looking at recidivism rates at post-treatment, our recidivism for folks who did strike the home was 23.3%. And at 3-month follow-up, it was 18.5%. So comparing the recidivism rates to other studies, I think these compare pretty favorably. But again, that depends on how you define recidivism, and everybody uses kind of different ways to assess these things. Our recidivism rates were based on report from the veterans who are going through our program and their partners. So we use this combined report. So it's not based on criminal justice data, for example.
Right. And I know that reports from partners tend to be more accurate than criminal justice data.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Criminal justice data, there's so many more incidents that never get reported on or never, you know, where there aren't any arrests made. So criminal justice data don't really, you know, aren't really very good data, to be frank.
So you developed a Strength at Home program for veterans and their families, veterans who had been abusive towards their partners. And you recognize that veterans have unique needs that aren't always found in the general population of offenders, particularly trauma and trauma-related types of problems. So tell me about the kind of approach that or approaches that Strength at Home uses with these veterans. For example, is it primarily a group modality that you use? Do you bring in the families? So I guess walk us through a program that a particular, or let's say a specific veteran would undergo from the time that they call, and what kind of screening tools do you use? And then tell us a little bit about the kinds of interventions that this veteran would expect going through Strength at Home.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and to start out, I just want to address what you said at first about veterans experiencing trauma, and that, you know, that may be more of an issue for them. And actually, now that we're piloting Strength at Home with civilians now in Rhode Island, we're getting court mandated civilians. And our experience thus far in doing Strength at Home with civilians is that they actually seem to report more severe trauma than the veterans we worked with. The stories that we're hearing of the folks we're working with, you know, where most of them have, you know, served long jail times. Most of them described having been shot or stabbed before, and, you know, experiencing all different kinds of trauma. We're really noticing and really recognizing that the material in our program, you know, on trauma really seems to fit the civilian population pretty well too. So in our view, trauma-informed IPV intervention is really relevant for everybody. Although we started our work with veterans, and I think there's more social acceptance of doing trauma-informed work with veterans who use violence than with civilians. Although, you know, our stance is that trauma-informed IPV and trauma-informed intervention is really helpful for anybody who engages in IPV. But to answer your question, yeah. So, for the veterans, we use a lot of measures looking at trauma, their trauma histories and PTSD. For example, we'll use the PTSD PTSD checklist or the CAPS to assess PTSD, and there are various other measures to look at, you know, traumatic life histories, that sort of thing. And, you know, a lot of the same kind of measures that everybody else uses, the revised conflict tactics scales. We use the multidimensional measure of emotional abuse to look at psychological abuse.
Yeah, by Murphy and Hoover, right?
Yep. Substance abuse history, you know, the same kind of measures that probably most people use. And even the program itself, you know, we don't claim to have recreated the wheel here. You know, we do a lot of what a lot of other people have done. It's really did with the program is we took elements from other IPV programs that are out there, from PTSD interventions, and tried to bring them together in a way where we tried to kind of use what we thought were the most impactful elements from each of them. So we didn't completely recreate like an entirely new program. We're mostly kind of using what's out there and kind of bringing together these different streams of intervention in ways that we thought were helpful. So for example, at the beginning of the program, we use kind of motivational type strategies such as doing a pros and cons exercise, the pros and cons of being aggressive in relationships. The idea being that we want the veterans to think about what are the many ways that they've learned to be aggressive in relationships. And one of the ways they learn to be aggressive is they get something from it. So we want them to think about what are you getting from it? What are the benefits you receive from being aggressive in relationships? and these are the kinds of questions that these men have really never been asked before. And when we ask them to talk about what you're getting from aggression or abuse, and we're eliciting their responses, they're seeing that we really want to hear about their perspective. We really want to hear about their thinking about this and their experiences. And they realize that this is a place where they can openly talk about their abusive behavior, and they can be open and honest about their issues and their problems. And then we talked about all the negative consequences of their abuse. And of course, that list is much longer. And we're able to make the case that, you know, their abusive behavior really isn't working for them. It has all these negative consequences, but they get these temporary benefits that's reinforcing the abuse and keeping it going. So we then make the pitch that we want to teach them another way to get those benefits, but without all those negative consequences. Right. We do a lot of processing of trauma during these early sessions. Processing of their resistance, you know, their unhappiness about being there, how they feel they've been, you know, blamed or unfairly treated, what have you. We invite a lot of that discussion really to help them work through it and process it, and you know, hear what other folks have to say about it, rather than kind of directly jumping in and trying to confront it right away. And what we find is the more that we process this early on, and the more that folks feel like they're heard, and we don't validate victim blaming or system blaming or agree with it or anything like that, but just us hearing them out and hearing their stories, having them talk about their trauma experiences during those early sessions, what we find is that they really kind of let their guard down after that. And their resistance sort of melts away. So by the time we get to session 3 and session 4, there's pretty much little or no victim blaming that usually occurs in our groups after the first few sessions, because really we process that fully during the first couple of weeks so they don't feel like they need to keep bringing it up, which allows us to really get to the work of the therapy, which is a lot of the standard stuff that you're already familiar with, you know, recognizing you know, cues for anger and abusive behavior, understanding their physiological, you know, components of their anger, their thoughts and feelings, learning to take timeouts, learning how to communicate better. There's a lot of assertiveness training that goes on, because a lot of folks who've experienced trauma tend to be overly passive in relationships or overly aggressive, and very, very often they've never really learned to be assertive. A lot of teaching how to express feelings, a lot of the similar kinds of things that folks are already familiar with. Another emphasis in our program is understanding social information processing deficits, or the ways that folks can distort or misinterpret their partners or other social situations. So when people have trauma or trauma-related problems, often what happens is they learn to see the world through a negative or hostile lens.
Yeah.
And they assume that other people are out to get them. They assume their partner's trying to push their buttons or has some kind of hostile intent. So helping the veterans recognize those negative ways of thinking can be really helpful for them to kind of correct themselves and see things in a different light and to not assume the worst across situations.
So what? So that seems to be a major difference between clients who don't come in with trauma and those who do. The ones who, because all clients need, in my opinion, some help with emotion management and mm-hmm. also need to learn communication skills. But it sounds like what you're saying is that individuals who've experienced trauma, it's even harder for them to manage their emotions. It's harder for them to read social cues because of the impact of the trauma itself or for some secondary reasons.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I'm sure we've all worked with folks who will describe having difficulty trusting partners because of a bad experience they had with a partner in the past. Yeah. And it's basically along those lines. If something negative has happened in the past, it might make it more difficult to trust people, or maybe it affects their self-esteem. Maybe it impacts their power and control issues, and all of these things play out in terms of how they interpret their partner.
Right. But I guess what I'm asking is above and beyond just a history with one's partner, a history of trauma prior to one's relationship, say, you know, in Afghanistan and in a active war zone, what kind of trauma related problems might actually directly impact one's ability to manage emotions or to communicate? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, veterans who wake up and I've heard people tell me that they've woken up in the middle of the night and just started swinging, you know, and unfortunately mm-hmm. sometimes their partner's there. And are these special needs that that trauma victims have to be addressed in a different way in groups, or have maybe more attention paid to in compared to clients who don't have that trauma history?
Well, it's interesting. Interesting question, because to be honest, so in our randomized controlled trial of 135 men, every single one of them reported a trauma history. So I think when we're working with these guys, and not necessarily just veterans, but civilians too,
right.
Most of them have some kind of trauma. If you assess it, you know, at least 90% of the guys in pretty much any court mandated population of those engaging in abuse have some kind of trauma history, you know, whether it's child abuse or witnessing abuse or witnessing, you know, whatever it is, almost all of these guys have something like that. It's probably true that some forms of trauma may be more likely to lead to those kinds of ways of thinking where you assume the worst in everybody. That's certainly true. There's some kinds of trauma that are worse. But I would honestly say that, you know, I can't really think of many situations where we were talking about trauma in one of our groups and nobody could relate to it. You know, usually pretty much everybody can relate to it. Not necessarily everybody has PTSD from their trauma. There it's more, you know, maybe 50% might have PTSD.
That's what I was going to suggest, Casey, that mm-hmm. we have in California, we have mandatory arrest laws. So, police often pick up individuals who really have no trauma history at all, never mind PTSD. And so they're pretty reasonably well-adjusted people. They had an encounter with a partner and got out of hand. And then there's those individuals. And then there's the ones, as you say, who may have experienced trauma when they were younger, but more like what's known as complex trauma, complex PTSD. It may not be directly related to some severe one-time incident or severe trauma conditions, but accumulation of abandonment issues and maybe witnessing some moderate domestic violence and growing up in a poor neighborhood and a number of things that altogether would indicate a trauma history, but not on the same par as say someone who's had, you know, who has nightmares every night following, a service in Afghanistan or somewhere mm-hmm. else. There's a war theater. So just wondering if there are fine gradations in terms of your treatment efforts or approaches based on the level of trauma that people suffer.
Well, no, we don't offer different groups, for example, that vary on levels of trauma, because like I said, and I can't really think of any examples where we talk about trauma and nobody can relate to it, you know? And I think, you know, probably, I'm sure even in California, if you gave folks a trauma measure, you know, folks who are going through your group, you probably have like over 90% will report trauma or higher. I think, you know, we've done some research on a local abuser intervention program too, right, in the community, who similarly found really high rates. And even if they don't endorse trauma per se, you know, anybody can relate to the idea that negative past experiences impact the way we view the world today, you know, impact our ability to trust other people, again, or power and control or self-esteem. I think these are kind of core themes that underlie negative experiences and that are sort of universally impact abusive behavior. So I hear what you're saying, and it's certainly true that, you know, in any group, you're going to get some guys who come in with raging PTSD, and they have this, they're constantly in survival mode, and they are making negative assumptions about people left and right and flying into a rage, you know, constantly. And they're folks who, you know, maybe, you know, you might, just like in any group, you know, there's folks who, there's certain elements of the group that might be especially helpful for them, working on with their kind of survival mode ways of thinking, and you know, and their overall fight or flight response is kicked into overdrive all the time. So, you know, they might need more kind of relaxation kind of strategies, that sort of thing. Whereas for somebody else, it might be more of a problem with communication or emotional expression, or you know, or they need more assertiveness training. But I think in any group, you're going to have different folks in the group who have different needs and who really might benefit more from one session or another, just like with any other kind of group. But we've never felt that, you know, our group, you know, was, you know, too trauma focused for anybody in the group. It always feels like the material fits and is appropriate for pretty much everybody in the group.
Oh, okay. So, and how long are the groups typically?
They're 2 hours, 12 weeks. So it's cognitive behavioral therapy. They're small groups, usually 5 to 8 guys in a group, sometimes even less. So they're obviously much shorter than what you do in California, right?
Yeah, 52 weeks here.
Yeah, right. But they, you know, our groups are therapy. They're intensive group therapy. We have small groups. They're usually led by social workers or psychologists, and they're pretty intense. And we cover a lot of ground in 12 weeks. It's kind of a trade-off in that the groups are smaller, they're shorter but more intense versus a longer group with like larger group numbers that, you know, maybe aren't getting into every individual's personal issues.
So what other modalities do you use, Casey, besides group? Do you sometimes see these men individually? Do you have separate groups for female offenders? I know you have a couples program, which I'd like you to talk a little bit about, but to what extent do you involve the family or see these men individually at certain times?
So, and just to give a little bit of context, and we could maybe talk about it a little bit more, when I say, like, when I'm referring to the group, I'm referring mainly to, at this point, we've been implementing these programs across the VA healthcare system. So we've trained many, many folks at different VA hospitals to do the group. So thus far, around 30 or so VA hospitals, we've trained their staff, mainly in the social work departments, to these groups with primarily court-ordered veterans. And the modalities are really, we're primarily group focused. We're almost exclusively group focused. It's very rare, and only in a handful of instances through all these hospitals that we've implemented the program has anybody seen individually. And that will be in a very rare case where perhaps somebody has such extreme PTSD that they find it impossible to sit in a room with a group full of strangers. And that often happen. Well, that doesn't often happen, but in the handful of cases where that's happened, there's been military sexual trauma, and it's just been too difficult for them to be in a room with strangers. We do separate groups for women, although, of course, we don't tend to get that many women who are referred to the program. So usually those groups are much smaller, with, you know, two or three women usually at most. And, you know, we include the partners in the same way that most other programs include the partners, in that we reach out to them to get their perspective, to give, to do, you know, do a safety assessment and safety planning with them, to give them referrals and information and hotline numbers and that sort of thing, and to get their perspective on the abuse that, that may have occurred. So, you know, we reach out to the partners in a coordinated way, like most programs do, and I think that is really, you know, just good practice.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so tell us about the couples program.
So, yeah, the couples program is sort of, I mean, it's an entirely different thing, and we're not implementing that at the VA right now. We are focusing more on active duty military for our couples program, and focusing more on military installations. So the couples program is for couples who have not engaged in recent IPV. But it's for military couples who are at risk for violence, either because they're reporting relationship distress or psychological abuse. Uh-huh. And so the idea is, we want to catch them usually after a deployment, when they're on the base, before they return home and their patterns of abusive behavior escalate into physical violence. So we these are really prevention programs that we are implementing on military bases. And right now we have a grant funded through the Department of Defense to implement this program at Madigan Hospital in Tacoma, Washington, Joint Base Lewis-McChord. So we're doing an implementation study to see what gets in the way of implementing this program on that installation, see what are the barriers are and facilitators are for doing that. We've also trained a large number of Air Force family advocacy program workers to deliver the program. So that's really more of a prevention program for couples that we're doing more with active military, because by the time they're discharged and they become veterans and they've, you know, been in the community for a while, you know, that may very well be too late. So we want to catch them as soon as we can after deployments.
Well, are there particular criteria by which you decide who can participate in these programs? You said no ongoing physical abuse. How do they find you? How do you determine who's appropriate?
Yeah, that's really the big challenge, because and we're fighting this for our, you know, for our study that's going on right now, is that we have to find ways to reach the partners, because the service members themselves are not necessarily kind of kicking down our door to do couples therapy or to do a prevention kind of program. So this is really what we're trying to figure out, is how can we reach partners directly. So we do a lot of talks. I fly back and forth between here and Tacoma to give talks at what's called Strong Bonds events or Yellow Ribbon events, various events they have for military families when they return from a deployment, or just have these events there. So basically, we try to reach directly to the partners any opportunity we can find to directly appeal to them. And that's really what seems to work the best to reach them.
What does the program look like, Casey? Is it 12 weeks? Is it shorter, longer? And what kind of
material
do you use?
It's a little bit shorter. Yeah, it's a little bit shorter. And the material is fairly similar. So it's 10 weeks. A lot of what we do in the other program, we do with the couples in a more kind of interactive basis, where they're interviewing each other a lot, using a lot of active listening when they're doing these assignments with each other. We build in positive exercises too, like you've been caught doing something nice, where every day each member of the couple marks down something positive that their partner did for them that day and lets them know they appreciate them doing the positive stuff. So we tend not to only focus on the negative things going on in the relationship, but also try to highlight and emphasize the positive. But you know, other than that, a lot of the same kinds of things that you're familiar with, you know, a lot of communication training, trying to be more assertive, trying to identify and express feelings better, teach them timeouts, all the kinds of things you might expect.
So how long has the couple's program been going on, and have you done any research on outcomes?
Yeah, so we were fortunate 10 years ago when we got the DOD funding for our other program we've been talking about. We got Centers for Disease Control funding for this couples program. So really, we evaluated these programs at the same time, you know, as we were going, and the timing of it all worked out really well. And similarly, as for the other Strength of Home program we've been talking about for those who engage in violence, we similarly found that this program was effective through our trial as well. We compared those who were doing this Strength of Home couples program to those who were doing a supportive therapy couples program, where they were essentially like support groups. We published those results in the Journal of Consulting and Clinical Psychology a few years ago, if folks are interested in checking it out. So we do have some evidence for it, and as far as I know, it's the only study using a randomized controlled trial that's shown to prevent and reduce abuse in couples in this way.
Oh, that's fantastic. That's fantastic. I think a lot of therapists who work with cases of intimate partner violence who have the option in various states to work with couples, especially couples where the violence hasn't gotten so out of hand that people are unsafe, probably would want to know more about your program and probably would want to contact you and find out more about it. Does your program use any of the methods and material used in by Peter Neidig with his Navy program back in the 80s? Are you familiar with that? That they used to do a 10-week couples program, and it was more, it was kind of along the lines of yours. It was for couples where maybe there was some violence, but very low level active military Navy couples.
I've read about it. I know that, but I've never actually seen the program itself. No.
Yeah. Well, my understanding of that program, it sounds a lot like yours, teaching basic communication skills, using experiential exercises, using role plays, different things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think there's only so many different kind of strategies to use for these problems. Yeah. Right. So you can't really do any kind of couples program without teaching them how to listen better and how to be more assertive and express feelings. So naturally, there's going to be a lot of overlap. We also include some trauma elements, too, where we have the couples interview each other about how they may have learned their own communication style in ways of expressing feelings, which oftentimes ends up leading to discussions about trauma experiences and how that impacts how they communicate today. So we do bring the trauma element through, you know, throughout the program too, which might be a little bit different than some other programs that are out there.
So to build empathy and goodwill and tell me about projects that you're starting or about to start that might be a little different from what we've talked about today. Any other types of populations that you're going to try to target, or different or new programs that you're going to try to implement?
So yeah, well, I've touched on, I think, the main ones. So really, our implementation of Strength at Home in the VA is a big effort. We're funded through the Bob Woodruff Foundation to do that. So every year we train 10 new VA, I personally train 10 new VA hospitals, and we train 10 new regional trainers, or like master trainers, who go out and train other sites as well. And this is something we've been doing for about the past 4 years with the goal long-term of training the entire VA healthcare system. So that's a pretty big undertaking that takes up a lot of our time here. And then the study I mentioned that we're doing at out in Tacoma at the military base, piloting Strength of Home for civilians, which is something we're very interested in. And hopefully a larger randomized controlled trial will follow this. That's really what we want to do, because we really, like I've been saying, we really want to show that trauma-informed intervention is relevant for everybody, not just military folks, but civilians as well. Also really interested in adapting Strength at Home for Native populations, Native American populations. That's something we're really interested in. a population that's been exposed to a whole lot of trauma. So a trauma-informed intervention you might think would be especially important, and also an intervention that isn't overly confrontational and that's respectful of folks. I think that's the only kind of program that's going to work with a native population.
Who are naturally suspicious of government agencies, correct?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, you're not gonna use a Duluth model program for folks who've experienced a lot of trauma and who are understandably mistrustful of mainstream providers. Yeah. So I think a trauma-informed approach is helpful for every population, but for the Native population, Native American population, I think that's especially important. So that's the direction we want to go in for sure. It's not easy work. It's not easy work to do. You know, for the very reason you described, it's not easy to find such a population who is going to invite you in and let you do a research study.
And it's been highly understudied. In fact, several years ago, when I was working on the second edition of my book on domestic violence treatment, I went out of my way to try to find articles, any kind of information on working with Native populations, and I found like one book chapter in one book. Mm-hmm. And that was it.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Very true. We would have to obviously work with them in a collaborative way to really have them teach us about what's the best way to do this, right? Yeah, and because I, from all that I've been told in kind of trying to gather information on this, a more community-focused approach where you're bringing in folks from the community, folks from the family, to collectively work on these issues is probably the most appropriate kind of angle to take. So I think ultimately it could look very different than what your kind of stereotypical or traditional IPV interventions might look like.
Right. For example, the one, as I recall, the book chapter that I was reading about, it was written by a man named Robert Kiosh, and he did programs for abusive men in Vancouver, British Columbia, and in his program, they incorporate Native traditional types of practices, the certain ceremonies that are particular to various indigenous tribes, and that without those Native practices, the cognitive behavioral and other, classic interventions wouldn't be well received.
Mm-hmm. Ah, that's interesting. I'll have to get that chapter.
I'll be happy to send it to you if you. I'll send you the citation. So anyway, great to speak with you today. I look forward to seeing you again and following your research. Casey, anything you wanted to add that we didn't talk about?
No, I think we covered all the good stuff. Yeah.